This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There are some who want to move on, but it is critical not to forget, to remember moments like this one when the Capitol building of the United States was under attack on January 6th. In the House gallery, members of Congress and staff were taking shelter wherever they could as the insurrectionist mob pushed closer to the House chamber. There's a photograph showing a man gripping a walkie-talkie, peering over the balcony to survey the chaos below. Other people are crouching behind chairs, the whites of their masks in stark contrast with their dark suits. And in the photo's foreground, Representative Susan Wilde lays on the ground. Her mask is tucked below her chin, her left hand splays across her chest. And Representative Jason Crow is kneeling at her feet, steadying himself with one hand and clutching Representative Wilde's hand with the other. And Representative Crow joins us now. Congressman, can I ask you, at that moment when that photograph was taken, what was going through your mind?
Hi, Meghna. There were a lot of things going through my mind. I had just called my wife and told her that I loved her and to tell the kids that I loved them. This is the first time I had felt like I would be in a position to have to either make a stand or fight my way out of a situation since I had been in Iraq and Afghanistan more than 15 years ago. At the same time, you know, my friends, my colleagues, Susan and others, were just as afraid as everybody and as me. And I just wanted to provide some comfort and let her know that I would be there for her and I wouldn't let any harm come to her.
Well, Representative Crow represents, he's a congressman from Colorado's 6th Congressional District and also a former Army Ranger, as you just heard him describe. How close was it, Congressman Crow?
It was too close. You know, it was a catastrophic security failure last week and a terrible situation, but it could have been much worse. I mean, we were trapped. There was about two dozen members of Congress that were trapped in that House gallery for about a half an hour. So we were surrounded by the mob, gunshots going off, tear gas flooding the Capitol. We had barricaded the doors with furniture, locked the doors. The mob had completely surrounded us at one point. We're trying to ram the doors down. You know, I've seen riots. I've seen mobs in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I know what they're capable of. If they had broken through that door, it could have been very bad.
Now, there hasn't been any formal public briefings from members of the Trump administration in any of the agencies of concern regarding the 6th of January attack. But I presume you've had some private briefings, and also you put out a readout of a call that you had with Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy. So let me just ask you clearly, Congressman Crow, based on what you have learned since the 6th of January, do we have reason to believe that the intent of at least some of the members of that mob was to take members of Congress hostage, possibly even kill them?
Well, I don't think we have to guess about that. I mean, that's what the mob was yelling. I mean, people don't show up in tactical gear with flex cuffs and yell things like build the gallows and bring out the guillotine without you know, having that intent. I mean, they were pretty clear. I don't think we have to read anyone's mind. They were very, very violent people. You know, their correspondence online in advance of the riot indicated as much as well. So, I mean, their intent was pretty clear. I think they were trying to kill members of Congress or take us hostage. And I think they would have done so had they had the opportunity. But, you know, I also think we need to reflect on the fact that we are 6 days after an attack on the U.S. Capitol, an insurrection that was designed to derail our democracy and the democratic process. And there hasn't been one single military or law enforcement briefing by this administration. Now, we know who Donald Trump is, that he's a dangerous and volatile and unstable person. But the story continues to be one of complicity by those that surround him. And there needs to be accountability for that.
So the House Democrats, I should say, are moving in that direction. What do you think true accountability looks like? What would you prefer it to be regarding President Trump?
Well, I think there's several levels of accountability. The first is accountability for President Trump, who bears primary responsibility. We're going to move forward with impeachment very soon, within the next 24 hours. You know, it was our hope that this would be an awakening for Vice President Pence and members of the cabinet, who frankly enabled this, allowed this to happen. You know, we've known for years who Donald Trump is and the danger that he poses. The complicity and the enabling of folks around him have allowed us to get to this point. And it was my hope that they would accept responsibility and pick up and discharge that obligation and invoke the 25th Amendment. I, of course, am not holding my breath that that's going to happen. So I think we're going to have to step up and lead again and impeach him and find a way to either get him removed as quickly as possible or bar him from holding office after he leaves on the 20th. The second level of accountability has to be for the rioters, and we're going to pursue justice through the Department of Justice and FBI as vigorously as we can. And then third is for those lawmakers that were complicit and incited the riot as well. You know, we have to make sure we're pursuing all avenues for domestic security, for our national security, and for the healing of the country.
Well, as you know, there's already some pushback from Republican members of Congress about exactly the sort of structure of accountability that you just laid out, Representative Crow. So first of all, I just want to play a little bit of tape. We did reach out to several dozen members of Congress, both Democratic and Republican, and no Republican member of Congress agreed to join us, by the way. But here is Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio on Fox News on Sunday.
Now the Democrats are going to try to remove the president from office just 7 days before he's set to leave anyway. I do not see how that unifies the country.
Congressman Crow, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. Well, I mean, Jim Jordan is so far gone and so depraved. I mean, he has no credibility in any of these debates, certainly not with respect to unity. I mean, the projection and the gaslighting of folks like Jim Jordan and others is really astounding. You know, they, of course, are responsible for bringing us here and are trying to shift that responsibility. And I would understand why, because they don't want to assume responsibility. But the American people, the vast majority of American people are good people. They're good-hearted folks. They know better. They know what's going on here. They will push back, and we will continue to push back as well.
Well, there have been a couple of polls that have come out that show that the majority of the American people do condemn the attack on Congress. However, once you expand the area of focus beyond the actual attack to the question of accountability, once again, we see the extremely profound partisan divides in this country. I mean, we even received a message from an On Point listener named Chris, who listens to us in Oklahoma, and here's what he said. He actually blames Democrats.
Oh, my God, they rushed the White House. Oh, my God, for 4.5 years, you've done nothing except tear down whatever party we've had left, only because we elect a guy that is not the usual politician. He's not from an inside the beltway. The people out here in the real world, the 74 million people that voted for him, that's what we voted for, somebody that is not in the beltway.
So, Congressman Crow, there are the things that Congress can do to hold elected officials to account, and in fact, must do to protect our democracy. But our democracy is made up of 330 million Americans, and people like Chris are among them. If you had a chance to talk to him, what would you say about the actions, why you think Congress needs to take the actions that you outlined a few minutes ago?
Well, this is our leadership challenge, right? Our leadership challenge is we need to have reconciliation, that we need to find a way to move forward to heal our nation. But at the same time, there can't be unity and moving forward without some level of accountability that requires truth and accountability. So the proper balance between those two is our leadership challenge in the months and years ahead, how we decide to balance those two competing requirements. And I would talk to that gentleman and I would try to find common ground. You know, I come from a Republican background. I grew up in a Republican family. I grew up in a working class family, construction family that I have a lot of friends and family members that support Donald Trump. So I understand that frustration. We have to find a way to find the common humanity in each other, to find those things we have in common. That's going to be extremely hard. You know, I say that as somebody that you know, that less than a week ago was sitting in the chamber and didn't know whether I was going to return home to my family, whose life was in danger. That said, I love this country very deeply. I believe in it. And we have to move forward. You know, my friend Connor Lamb summed it up last week right after the attack. He said, we want to build this country and build it up more than they want to tear it down. And that remains true today, just like it was last week.
I have you for a minute and a half left, Congressman Crow. Let me ask you, I read a report in the HuffPost this morning about briefings that members of Congress have received in the past day or two about additional plots to overthrow the United States government, including plans to surround the Capitol with armed insurrectionists again. And there's this quote from in the HuffPost of, for example, they had an eyes wide open realization. A member told HuffPost that the Capitol Police need to take precautions against all of these members who were in league with the insurrectionists who love to carry their guns. You can't just let them bypass security and walk right up to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris at the inauguration. How much danger are members of Congress or even the incoming administration actually in?
Yeah, I was on that briefing last night as well. And here's the reality. Last week, we saw the birth and the awakening of a domestic terror movement. This is not going away. It's not small and isolated. The president has succeeded in radicalizing his fringe followers, people, some of whom have military and law enforcement backgrounds that have very dangerous weapons. Our challenge is we have to figure out how we address that. We have to get Joe Biden into office, get the political appointees he needs, the cabinet officials he needs, and we have to ensure the domestic security. There are dangers ahead, but with good people, we can deal with those dangers.
Representative Jason Crow, Democratic Congressman for Colorado's 6th Congressional District, former Army Ranger, joining us from Aurora, Colorado. Congressman Crow, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
When we come back, we'll talk more about what accountability looks like. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're exploring today what accountability could or should look like for lawmakers, for President Trump in the wake of the attack on Congress of January 6th. Now, we've heard from a lot of On Point listeners. Keep calling us and leave us a message at 617-353-0683 about your thoughts, your desires of how America moves forward legally and politically to strengthen our democracy, to protect it. Again, 617-353-0683. Here is what Colleen from New Orleans said in support. She supports impeaching President Trump.
How anyone cannot impeach someone who is directly responsible for not only COVID response and all the deaths associated with that, but the seditious riot. If we don't enforce consequences, then this will happen again, and it will be worse, and we'll have asked for it.
Pamela from Stamford, Connecticut, also adds that she thinks Republican lawmakers who denied or rejected the election results should also be held accountable.
The politicians who have been spreading lies and backing President Trump with his spreading of lies, they need to admit the truth as part of accountability. I believe they should be expelled from their positions. They should not be able to run again for office. And they should publicly state that they were wrong, take accountability for their actions with the truth.
Well, joining us now is Kate Shaw, professor of law at Yeshiva University's Cardozo School of Law, with us from Brooklyn, New York. Professor Shaw, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Washington is Olivia Troy. She's a former Homeland Security Counterterrorism and Coronavirus Advisor for Vice President Mike Pence. She resigned from that post in August. Olivia, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna.
So, Olivia, actually, I first wanted to start with you, and we will get to this, the deeper question of accountability in a second, but given the fact that you work so closely with Vice President Pence, for so long in 2020 on the coronavirus task force. Can you just share your first thoughts when it was clear that he himself was under a great deal of danger on January 6th?
Yeah, you know, watching it sort of unfold, I have to say that I was shocked that there was not significant more preparation to prevent that moment from happening. And as I saw the sitting vice president and our congressional leadership in potentially, you know, under the threat in harm's way, I kept thinking to myself, there is no way that all of the threat indicators were not there. These threat streams were real. They were evident. Everyone could see this happening and coming, especially if you were working in the national security space. And I kept thinking to myself, I mean, did they brief him? Did they tell the vice president that this was real, that it was going to happen, that it was going to ensue? And because certainly he knew to expect it, right? I mean, the wrath of Donald Trump when it turns on you is great. And we saw the president inciting this type of violence right before at the rally he held.
And naming Mike Pence by name.
Correct. And I had worried that the second that Mike Pence basically did his job, right, he had no power to do any of the things that these Republican lawmakers were espousing and that the president was also telling his followers that it was up to Mike Pence to overturn this election. That is just factually incorrect. It was lies. And the problem is when you're the president of the United States, words matter and your supporters are listening. And it was basically him calling people to arms against the sitting vice president. Mm.
Kate Shaw, I'm going to come to you in a second. Just hang on here. It's just that Olivia literally sat next to Mike Pence for months in 2020 working on the coronavirus task force. So, Olivia, I've got to ask you, not that you can get inside of the vice president's head, but amongst anyone I've spoken to, you know him better than anyone. And I wonder, he has resisted or at least not followed on calls to invoke the 25th Amendment. Now, if the risk of losing his own life following the incitement of an insurrectionist mob by President Trump isn't enough to convince the vice president to take some kind of action, can you help explain that? Can you walk us through what he's thinking right now or what his actual line would be for accountability?
Well, I do think that there is an element of fear here. I think what happened at the Capitol, watching the anger in his speech that was very evident and something that the vice president doesn't really show publicly much emotion, right? He holds his cards close to his chest. And I think it's true fear that for his life, for the life of his family, who I understand was with him at the Capitol and others. And I think at this moment, the issue we have here is that I think he's weighing it carefully. He's deciding, you know, would such an action create more violence across the country? Does this move the 25th Amendment or invoking something like that? Would that just radicalize these people even more? But unfortunately, I also have to say that these radicalized individuals are the Trump base, a lot of them, right? These are Trump supporters. These are Trump followers. And these are also the followers of many of the individuals who should be held accountable that are Republican lawmakers who are in elected office right now, who continue to perpetuate these conspiracy theories and these lies. And so if that's the base of the party going forward, there is a part of Mike Pence that is thinking in 2024, who were the voters? Is this the base still? And am I running for president? And these are my voters. I have no doubt that that is also part of the calculus, which is very unfortunate because we are in a very dangerous situation for his life, for President-elect Biden's life. Somebody needs to stand up and do the right thing.
Olivia, what you're describing is a nation that's being held politically hostage by people who don't believe in the very democracy they're supposedly participating in.
This is a very low point for our country.
Professor Shaw, I appreciate your patience in listening to Olivia there. Your thoughts on what she just said?
It's so striking to hear the suggestion, and I think you've heard it echoed elsewhere, that a number of members of the president's party may be failing to step forward to seek accountability out of actual fear of the consequences for, you know, even for themselves and their families. So it's striking to hear that that might be a factor in Vice President Pence's consideration of whether to invoke the 25th Amendment. And I do think it speaks to just how precarious this moment is. But I think it seems as though there is potential danger, whatever path, you know, the country and its leaders go down. So I think that the possibility of the message sent by inaction, by failure to pursue some serious accountability, and whether that takes the form of the 25th Amendment or impeachment or an attempt to persuade the president to resign, whatever that accountability looks like, the failure to aggressively pursue it seems to me at least as dangerous a path as pursuing any of these options.
So that's an excellent point here. Frank, just to be explicit about it, this is a no good options situation for sure. But, you know, people spend hundreds, if not thousands of hours, and there's thousands of people in government whose job is to, for every potential scenario, go through those decision trees to find the least bad option. So there's the do nothing, there's 25th Amendment, there's impeachment, there's also the 14th Amendment, which I want to talk to you about in a second, Professor Shaw. Of those all not great options, which one do you actually think is the least bad?
You know, I do think that, I hope it's right. Olivia suggests that there may be active consideration of the 25th Amendment, or at least certainly the vice president hasn't publicly ruled it out. I think the advantage there is speed, right? So under the Constitution, all that is required to invoke Section 4 of the 25th Amendment is a declaration by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. And that's, you know, not a phrase that is defined in the Constitution. It is pretty clear that when the amendment was drafted, you know, physical inability was what was contemplated. But it certainly seems to me that having fomented a violent insurrection, an attack on the seat of government, does represent inability to discharge the duties of the office, right? You know, upholding the Constitution is at the core of the president's duties. And I think there's a very strong argument that this attack on, you know, the Capitol and democracy itself is fundamentally inconsistent with the president's oath to uphold the Constitution and suggests that he is unable to perform his job. And so I think that the speed with which the 25th Amendment could be invoked and the kind of decisiveness of the repudiation of the conduct in that it would be the president's own, you know, handpicked team that would be sending the message of inability, that strikes me as a distinct advantage of the 25th Amendment. You know, I think impeachment can happen fast. It hasn't typically, but I think that these are extraordinary circumstances and the House could vote very quickly. And if the Senate wanted to return early and actually hold a one-day trial and take a vote, there's nothing in the Constitution preventing them from doing that. But it still, you know, would take some time, potentially drag on past January 20th. And I think that would mean that the early days of the Biden administration would be consumed with a Senate trial. And that might be worth it. It might well, but the 25th Amendment could all happen much faster.
Okay. So, Olivia, let me turn back to you here, because the 25th Amendment would also require the participation of Professor Shaw. Wait, remind me, how much of the cabinet? Two-thirds?
Just a majority.
Just a majority. Okay. Yep. Of the sitting cabinet or what? Because we keep having people resigning.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's not clear. It's also not clear whether acting secretaries can participate. So if it's just the confirmed cabinet, that's a smaller number, but it's a majority of the cabinet. So if the full cabinet counts, then that's 15 and you need 8. But if acting secretaries don't count, then they're presumably out of the denominator too. So whatever the number of the cabinet at the time that the vice president sought their agreement is, you just need, you know, half plus one of that. So if there's only 11, you know, cabinet members for purposes of the 25th Amendment. You would just need six of them to join the vice president in the declaration of inability.
But you're saying that we don't know if acting.
We don't know. It's never been invoked. And to be honest, I don't, you know, there could be a legal challenge, but I can't imagine anything would happen fast enough for a court to weigh in prior to January 20th.
Okay. So Olivia, so per what Professor Shaw just said, we don't know exact how many would need to be required to support the vice president in invoking the 25th Amendment. And at the same time, as I just noted, people keep resigning, like acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf, right, who just resigned as of midnight last night. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, there have been many moments where I think many members of this cabinet could have and should have resigned. So it is striking to me that after all of the things that have happened under this administration, that this would be the moment that Chad Wolf would suddenly decide that he needed to resign. And that really begs the question of what sort of investigation needs to happen on what should have been done in preparation for January 6th, and also really paling on your responsibilities right now at a moment that really matters, not only because there is a significant domestic threat happening right now that the nation is under, but also because really I think it's important for these cabinet members to sit there and support the vice president in this process and to stand by him and to encourage him to invoke the 25th Amendment and be there for this. So, you know, the question of how many cabinet members are necessary to invoke it is real, and that's a serious question. But I think right now, all of these individuals who are the leaders of our country in their roles need to take responsibility and action as soon as possible for the safety and security of our country.
You know, in his letter to members of DHS, Wolf wrote, I've got to get the right paragraph here because it's kind of a long letter. He says, okay, I am saddened to take this step as it was my intention to serve the department until the end of this administration. Unfortunately, this action is warranted by recent events, including the ongoing and meritless court rulings regarding the validity of my authority as acting secretary. These events and concerns increasingly serve to divert attention and resources away from the important work of the department in this critical time of a transition of power. Now, Olivia, recent events, and including the challenges to the fact that he served as acting secretary longer than legally allowed. I mean, why? This is an obvious question, but it has to be asked. Why is he not explicitly saying, does he even consider the attack on Congress as one of those recent events?
Yeah, I think that was one of the more striking things about that letter to me when I read it last night when he resigned, was the fact that the one thing he would highlight is his own selfish quest for a title, right? And that is something that I have seen that has been evident in the leaders across this administration. The quest for power and palace intrigue was real, but really what mattered at this moment was, why didn't he specifically say this has been a rising threat in our country? Why didn't he condemn the rise of these more extremes and these conspiracy theories and the far right and white supremacy, like all of these combinations? And also, I mean, to decide that you were going to just relinquish your responsibilities right before we're going into a presidential inauguration, when it is your responsibility as a Homeland Security person to ensure that all of these agencies come together, is just astounding to me.
How vulnerable does that leave the department since Wolf has resigned?
It's a very valid question. I think that there has been a lack of leadership and focus at the department for quite some time. I think that, you know, there are certainly components within DHS who have done great work. And it's my understanding that that work has actually ceased and could have actually made a difference possibly for January 6th. And so I think the important question right now is hopefully that Administrator Pete Gaynor is fully involved and engaged in the next week or so as we see the threats continuing on across the country. I hope he's engaging, rightly so, through the process of state and locals and coordinating closely with the FBI. But, you know, furthermore, Meghna, I hope that all of this encourages the Congress and the Senate to confirm the incoming Biden administration's nominee, Mayorkas, as soon as possible into that role. Mm-hmm. Because I think that these critical positions in national security should be filled as soon as possible, because these threats are not going away. They're not going away after January 20th. These threats are real. And we need someone in these positions who can start moving forward in protecting our country.
Yeah. Well, Olivia Troy, hang on. And Kate Shaw, stand by, because there's more questions about the legal path forward here, the constitutional path forward, that I want to ask to you, Professor Shaw. When we come back, we'll also hear from another member of Congress about what he thinks accountability needs to look like right now. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about whether the United States is facing a domestic insurgency right now and whether the attack on Congress on January 6th was a flash of that insurgency. And if so, what should this country be doing to combat it, both politically, both informationally, and even on the ground? So if you live, say, near a state capital in any one of the 50 states, are you concerned about activities happening around that capital? Do you know people who believe in the lie of the false results of the election and consider themselves part of an insurgency? Or thinking about joining a militia? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about what accountability ought to look like in the wake of that attack on the Capitol. I'm joined by Olivia Troy. She's a former Homeland Security, Counterterrorism, and Coronavirus Advisor to Vice President Mike Pence. She resigned from that position in August. Kate Shaw joins us. She's a professor of law at Yeshiva University's Cardozo School of Law and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. And joining us now from Phoenix is Congressman Ruben Gallego, Democratic Representative for Arizona's 7th District. Representative Gallego, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're also a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, Congressman. How much was what you experienced on January 6th evocative of your experience in combat?
Well, look, combat is a little different. Yeah. It's scarier than what I saw, but it was still very frightening. What I did see that was kind of evocative was I felt like this was what I had seen it sometimes in some of the cities that I was at, where the local religious leader or family tribal leader would essentially, you know, declare some type of fatwa or just, you know, be mad about something that we did, and then would gather all of his, you know, followers and family members and then send them against, you know, whatever assets that we had. And you see that happening all over the world, whether it's religious leaders or fanatical political leaders. This is what they do. They gather their people, get them all riled up, and then send them towards the power of the seat of, and then as they take over, you know, then they try to sue for peace afterwards. That's what I saw happening. So yes, this is an insurrection. It's a failed insurrection, but it's something that we need to be afraid of and be counteracting. And the way you counteract insurgencies are two ways. Number one, you counteract the misinformation that's happening. And I think that's something that we actively have to work with as, you know, with social media companies, with just media in general. You have to actually deal with some of the underlying issues that are being caused by this too, which can be varied, but some of it goes back to just, you know, huge income inequality. And then you also have to have a punitive side to this. We know where these militias are. We know where they are all over the world. We have some of the best, some of the best intelligence systems in this country, and we need to gear them to actually tracking down and destroying all of these domestic terror networks that we've allowed to fester for the last 4 years.
And for the leader of this movement, you're backing impeachment, a second impeachment of President Trump?
Absolutely. I'm backing the impeachment of Trump. And at the same time, we also need every Republican, to back the impeachment. And at a minimum, they need to stop spreading the lie. The problem that you have here is that there's this big lie happening by Republicans, and then it's just being repeated over and over again by these little minion Republicans and their own little network, that there was this massive voter fraud. And for some of the feeble-minded that are getting sucked into this, it's one thing when the president says it, but when you have a whole political apparatus that's also saying it, it's hard for the truth to break through. So when you hear these Republicans asking for reconciliation and time to move on, we can't move on when the underlying big lie is still there, right? If they continue to repeat the lie and while we just kind of, you know, brush off what happened, you're only going to have more and more of these insurrections happening. Because at the end of the day, every time Vice President Biden does something, they're just going to go back to the point that, well, you know, he's an illegitimate president, and therefore we have a right to push back against that.
Well, you know, we have heard even just in the immediate aftermath of the attack and the subsequent days, members of Congress, for example, trying to draw equivalencies between the insurrectionist mob that invaded the Capitol and the efforts of House Democrats to impeach the president for a second time. For example, here's Representative Ken Buck, Republican from Colorado, on CBS Denver. Here's what he said.
It was a mistake for Republican leadership to try to overturn the results of the Electoral College. It's a mistake for the Democrat leadership to try to impeach this president. I'm tired of Democrats pointing at Trump and his supporters and saying that they are burning down this country when the Democrats continue to stoke the fires of division.
Congressman Gallego, is that what Democrats are doing, stoking the fires of division?
No, absolutely not. Like, number one, we're for equality and justice. And because we actually do care about Black lives and we do understand that they are disproportionately targeted by law enforcement, it does not mean that we're actually trying to tear down this country. We're actually trying to make this country better. What happened on January 6th was people that actually attacked the Capitol. This is not someone breaking into some yogurt shop at the mall. They literally attacked the Capitol and try to overthrow the government and install a puppet president or a puppet president at a minimum. That is not equivalent, right? That is not equivalent at all. And the sad part about it is people like Ken Buck know that. Many of my colleagues are really bright people. And for one reason or the other, where they want to manipulate and get Trump support votes, or they're afraid of Trump himself, they're just lying to themselves and they're lying to their own people. It's this vicious circle and cycle that creates this drama because there's a total lack of courageous leadership up and down the Republican Party. I mean, there are some few exceptions. Let's give credit to where they exist. But, you know, we need more Mitt Romneys in the Republican Party than what we have right now.
Congressman Gallego, last question for you here, and I appreciate your time very much. Are you concerned at all, though, that if the House Democrats do move forward with impeachment, which is what the plan is, that it's entirely possible that the first several months or at least weeks of the Biden administration will be consumed by impeachment and not by the exact sort of Democratic plans and values and hopes that you had outlined earlier about bridging inequality, racial justice, et cetera, all the things that the Biden administration, incoming Biden administration, is hoping to accomplish?
Look, there is no greater value than preserving democracy. And I think we'll be able to do that. And lastly, you know, this whole thing, notion that we can't focus, we can do many things at the same time. This country has dealt with world wars and still balanced the budget and done many other amazing things. So This idea that it can't be done is I think, a false. Now, the most important thing that we have to worry about is, what if we don't do this? Mm-hmm. What are we saying to the rest of these insurrectionists or presidents in the future, that if you happen to do a unsuccessful coup 10 days before an election, Congress won't hold you accountable? Is that the message we want to say at the send? Because Trump might be back 4 years from now. What happens again if he loses, and he will, but, you know, he again sends the mobs to the Capitol, to attack the Capitol. Are we supposed to be forgiving then? How many more police officers have to die, right? So this is not a valid excuse. The Republicans want to turn over a new leaf, then they actually have to stop lying. They have to distance themselves from the president and truly understand and apologize for what they encouraged on January 6th, a true attack on democracy on the Capitol.
Congressman Ruben Gallego, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona, Democratic representative for Arizona's 7th. Congressman, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Kate Shaw, let me just play this piece of tape here from Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's actually putting the onus now on President-elect Joe Biden.
Joe Biden said, "It's up to Congress regarding impeachment. No, President-elect Biden, it's up to you. Pick up the phone, call Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and the squad and tell them, stand down. This will destroy the country even further. You have the power to do that. The question is, do you have the courage to do it?"
Professor Shaw, what do you think about that?
It's just, I find that such a hard argument to swallow for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is Congressman Gallego is just suggesting, it seems to me, that what Graham is asking for is a unilateral disarmament on the part of Biden and the Democrats when his party is unwilling to decisively repudiate the, you know, kind of architecture of argument that underlay the January 6th riot and storming of the Capitol. The idea that a lawfully conducted election that resulted in the victory of Joe Biden, you know, by 7 million popular votes and over 300 electoral college votes, that somehow that was illegitimate based on, you know, no facts on the ground at all, that unless and until I think Graham's party is unwilling, is willing to walk away from that kind of architecture of argument, I don't think they can, in good faith, ask the Democrats to fundamentally change their approach. So, you know, and it was so hard to hear Lindsey Graham make those arguments. I mean, the Washington Post, I think it was yesterday, some of its reporting from the sort of 6 hours of this siege suggested that Graham was on the phone with members of the president's family, pleading with them to get the president to make some statement, to call off the crowds, and that he was basically unsuccessful in doing that. So, I don't really see much legitimacy to the argument that Graham is making while his own party is unwilling to not even meet the Democrats halfway, but take any meaningful steps in the direction of reconciliation.
Look, I think the collective memory hole of the United States is vast and powerful because we seem to have already forgotten that just in the hours after the attack on the Capitol, or the next day, I believe, Lindsey Graham gave a press conference where twice he said his greatest concern was the country just getting through the next 14 days at that time. And now all of a sudden he's saying, Joe Biden, pick up the phone and solve this problem. Now, so we've talked about the 25th Amendment. We've talked about impeachment. But I did want to hear from you, Professor Shaw, about the 14th Amendment and Section 3, because some constitutional scholars are saying, if one of the ultimate goals is to prevent President Trump from ever holding office again, that impeachment itself would not achieve that, that it would be better for Congress to use the 14th Amendment. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, as to the 14th Amendment, so it's a pretty obscure provision of the 14th Amendment, the third section, which hasn't been used much. But basically, so the whole 14th Amendment is passed and ratified in 1868 in the wake of the Civil War. And this particular provision allows for the disqualification from public office of individuals who have engaged in or assisted insurrection or rebellion. So again, drafted in the wake of the Civil War, but broad enough in its language that a lot of people think that it could well be used to apply to this situation, and that it could serve the purpose of disqualifying President Trump from holding future public office, including the presidency. Now, we should say this is totally untested as to the president. It would likely require Congress to just pass a law under another provision of the 14th Amendment, the Section 5, basically finding that the president has engaged in or aided in insurrection and thereby is under Section 3 disqualified. And there would be hard questions of interpretation regarding whether the presidency is the kind of office under the United States that that the amendment contemplates, whether what happened Wednesday and President Trump's participation in it does constitute insurrection. But if those arguments were made successfully, they would, I believe, disqualify President Trump from running for or holding the office of president again. And I think the benefit of that approach as compared to impeachment is that this legislation would be passed like ordinary legislation. So it would just require, you know, passage in both houses of Congress and signature by presumably President Biden, who I can't imagine objecting. And that is in contrast to impeachment, which, you know, to successfully result in removal or conviction and removal requires two-thirds in the Senate.
Right.
But actually, one more point on impeachment, which is that it's right that, you know, ordinarily, you know, the main consequence of impeachment we're familiar with is removal from office. But there's a second consequence, the Constitution lays out, which is potentially disqualification of an impeached individual from future office holding. So actually, that's the reason the Democrats are talking about a post-January 20th impeachment trial, because if they could get to two-thirds on a conviction, under the Senate's rules, it only requires a majority vote to disqualify. So you'd still get, you'd still need 67 on the conviction. But if you could get that, you could just get 50 votes, and presumably the vice president could break a tie to disqualify Trump from holding future office. So both of those routes, I think, could potentially result in disqualification, though neither is easy.
I see. But the impeachment route, though, the step beforehand requires that the conviction in the Senate, whereas the 14th Amendment path, just to be clear, to put a bright line under it, would only require a simple majority in Congress versus the two-thirds of the majority of in the Senate that's required to remove the president through impeachment, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So, look, we've just got 2 minutes left here. And Olivia, I appreciate your patience in listening along. Just wondering if you might share your final thoughts for today, as it seems as, it, you know, every hour now, elected leaders, people working in government, they all have to make critical decisions that will be marked down in history and have an impact on us all. I just wonder if you want to just sort of, having been in that position, having been in government, just share your thoughts on what that might be like and what your hopes are for the next few days.
You know, I think that when you're called to serve, I think you are serving the American people and you take an oath to the country first and foremost. And I think this is the moment where every single person who is in an official role or in a role where they can make a difference needs to dig into their moral courage and step forward. And so hearing people like Lindsey Graham deflect, because that is what this is, it's deflection and trying to step away from their own personal responsibility and complicitness, to be honest, on what enabled this moment to happen. I think it's time for all of these people to be held accountable, hold themselves accountable, and step up. Because these movements, these supporters, they need to hear it from people like Lindsey Graham. They need to hear it from the Hawleys of the world, the Ted Cruzes. Those are the people that need to be speaking out right now and telling them enough is enough.
Olivia Troy, former Homeland Security, Counterterrorism, and Coronavirus Advisor to Vice President Mike Pence. Olivia, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Magda.
And Kate Shaw, Professor of Law at Yeshiva University's Cardozo School of Law and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. Professor Shaw, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.